Hello and welcome to the Modern Love edition of the New York Times Magazine for April 21st, 2024. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first article, Coming of Age. After 50, you know so much more about yourself that online dating, for all its frustrations, can bring unanticipated pleasures. And then from the letter of recommendation section, Neruda's love poems. And finally, the rom-com that's responsible for my marriage. The 1992 movie Singles changed my life. But first, online dating after 50 can be miserable, but it's also liberating. You know so much more about yourself and your desires when you're older that dating apps, even with all their frustrations, can bring unanticipated pleasure. This article was written by Maggie Jones. When my marriage collapsed after 23 years, I was devastated and overwhelmed. I was in my 50s with two jobs, two teenage daughters, one dog. I didn't consider dating. I had no time, no emotional energy. But then a year passed. One daughter was off at college, the other increasingly independent. After several more months went by, I started to feel a sliver of curiosity about what kind of men were out there and how it would feel to date again. The last time I dated was 25 years ago, and even then I fell into relationships mostly with guys from high school, college, parties, work. Now every man I knew was either married, too young, too old, or otherwise not a good fit. That meant online dating, the default mode not just for the young but also for people my age. My only exposure had been watching my oldest daughter home from college one summer as she sat on her bed rapidly swiping through guy after guy, spending no more than a second or two on each. Wait, I kept saying, slow down, how do you know? What's wrong with him or him? Soon enough, I signed on to Match, and then the dating apps Bumble and Hinge. And over the past 18 months, I felt waves of excitement, hope, frustration, boredom, discouragement. I've gone on great and not so great dates, had relationships and ended them, paused and restarted apps, over and over again. Online dating is a mixed bag for most people, queer, hetero, non-binary. Plenty of them do find love, including on their very first match. But many of us have to swim through a dispiriting sea of hundreds of people, most of whom we are unlikely to ever want to date. That includes profiles that are fake, created by scammers to try to lure private information from users. And while most profiles are real, sometimes their photos are not so much. More than one person told me that photos can be so outdated or filtered that they barely recognize their date when they met. And the writing is often littered with clichés. Looking for a partner in crime. I will make you laugh. I live life to the fullest. Then there's the irritating experience of seeing the people you already declined pop up again and again and again. As tough as the process can be, older women have it worse than most. They report more negative online dating experiences compared with men of all ages and younger women, according to a Pew Center for Research study. That may in part be because of their dearth of choices. The pool of men narrows with time. Men's life expectancy is 7 years shorter than women's. Then there's the reality that men tend to date younger women, a desire that online dating makes vividly quantifiable. In a 2018 study, researchers analyzed anonymized message exchanges between more than 186,000 straight men and women from a public and large online dating platform. Researchers didn't name which one. Women get the most attention from men, measured by the number of first messages a person receives when they are 18. Yes, 18, when they have barely crossed into adulthood, if you consider 18 an adult. It's also the first year they are legally allowed to even be on most dating sites. It's downhill from there. The study by Elizabeth Bruch, a sociology professor, and Mark Newman, a physics professor, both at the University of Michigan, didn't even include people older than 65. Men's desirability, in contrast, peaks more than three decades later, at around age 50, when women have become increasingly invisible. And although women prefer men with advanced degrees, men desire women who don't go beyond college. But as I learned over the last several months talking to more than three dozen people about online dating among older Americans like me, that's only part of the story. Researchers, along with people I interviewed who have been on the apps, suggested something more complex and nuanced about dating in the older years, by which I mean there may be reason for optimism. One Wednesday afternoon over Zoom from her living room in Manhattan, the anthropologist Helen Fisher, author of Anatomy of Love, A Natural History of Mating, Marriage, and Why We Stray, told me she is hopeful about online dating as you age. Despite the stereotypes, older women are not desperate. Fisher, who studies romantic relationships and dating, is a senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and chief scientific advisor to Match. For the past 13 years, along with the Kinsey Institute's executive director, Justin Garcia, she has collaborated with Match to create and analyze annual nationally representative surveys of roughly 5,000 single people about their romantic lives. When it comes to sexual attraction, Fisher, who is 78, says, "The older you get, the pickier you get." In one Match survey, people over 60 were more likely than younger people to insist on initial sexual chemistry for a long-term relationship, perhaps in part, Fisher says, because when you don't have to choose a partner who will be a good parent or help provide a secure home, you can focus on different desires. There's also less pressure to marry the second time around. Only 15% of previously married women say they want to do it again, according to a Pew study. The other 85% either didn't want to or weren't sure. That's half the portion of men who want to remarry. Michael Rosenfeld, a sociologist at Stanford University, whose research areas include mating and dating and the internet's effect on society, says the discrepancy is partly because, as numerous studies confirm, women tend to be less satisfied in heterosexual marriage. Some women, as he put it, are just tired of the ups and downs of relationships and have promised themselves they won't do it again. Men, by contrast, have narrower social circles and emotional friendships than women do. Without a partner, they can feel more adrift and remarry quickly. One man I talked to, who asked me to identify him by his middle initial, H, is in his late 50s and divorced, and has seen this among men his age. Men are not confident in their ability to be alone emotionally, keeping a social calendar, getting meals on the table. A lot of them need to be taken care of. That need can be on blatant display in dating apps. It's what Jenny Young, a professor of English and Women and Gender Studies at University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, calls the "Are You My Mother?" problem. In a Facebook post, she used the example of a man answering the online dating prompt, "We'll get along if," by writing, "You feed me and are more mature than I, LOL. Young, who wrote her dissertation in applied rhetoric, teaches a class for undergraduates called The Rhetoric of Dating and Intimacy. She argues that older women are more selective about dating. Our hormones are shifting. We have zero tolerance, especially those of us who have been on our own and don't feel we need a man to provide for us. Still, Young, who is 53 and divorced herself, wants to improve the dating experience for women and non-binary people by helping them learn how to interpret dating language. It's one way older women can catch up to Gen Z women who are better versed in online rhetoric, Young says. Older women were already partnered when online dating began and missed the dating app revolution. Young and I bonded, as I did with other women, over our shared exasperation with so many men's profiles, filled with selfies at the gym in which they were holding dumbbells and flexing, or in bathroom mirrors, sometimes with urinals behind them. One woman told me about a bathroom pic with a bra dangling from a shower rod. And the fish! So many men holding fish! Either because fishing is a favorite hobby or a display of masculinity or both. Who knows? On Instagram, Young recently posted two common rhetorical approaches: disciplinary directive, be feminine, no baggage, and I dare you, message me if you think you can handle it. I say no 99% of the time. She cited an example in which a man combined the two by saying, "Understand this is a dating site you join to meet someone, not to text to death, LOL. If you want to meet me, act like it. I'll know you are serious when I get your number." For Young, trying to figure out how to date better and more efficiently started one night 3 years ago when she was feeling pitiful about her own experiences online. Rife with misogyny and cliched nonsense, she did a Google search for how do you find a needle in a haystack? The answer? Burn the haystack to the ground. Only the metal needle will remain. She decided to try it as a dating method. Instead of widening her filters and her tastes, which some dating advisors suggest, she became choosier about men and their styles of communication. She responded only if they sent her a clear, personalized message, and if she wasn't interested in a man, she didn't just swipe left or X out his profile, she blocked or removed him, which isn't the same as reporting someone for inappropriate behavior. The goal was to prevent further messages and reduce the odds those men would reappear in her feed and waste more of her time. She also revised her profile to repel some men while, she hoped, drawing those who were better matches. To that end, she wrote a top 10 list of her dating rules, which included no hookups and no messages of, "Hey, you up?" or "What's up?" And no 55-year-old man who says he wants kids someday. She also posted what she likes to do: bike, hike, write humor, emphasizing that, while it's common to say a version of "I'm funny" in profiles, she has actually published satire. She ended with, "I can't be attracted to anyone who doesn't know their homonyms. I'm sorry." She conceded the last line might sound elitist, but it was accurate. In the next few days, while fewer men liked her, the ones who did suited her more, including a man named Scott, who commented, "Hey, sorry, couldn't resist. This is hands down the best profile I've ever read," which, if we're being honest, probably isn't saying much considering the majority of the profiles out there, but it's definitely something. Scott soon became her partner for more than 2 years. Young credited her method for her successful match, and last year she started a Facebook group called the Burned Haystack Dating Method, which now has about 50,000 followers. She also has an Instagram account where she dispenses advice. As she wrote in one article about the strategy, "Dating is a numbers game, but the typical goal, to be widely appealing and meet as many men as possible, is wasting women's time and leaving us frustrated and demoralized." At first, she mostly drew followers in their 40s, 50s, and older, but increasingly younger women have joined. She advises women to be businesslike in their approach. Check apps no more than twice a day. Make sure your language is specific. No, "I love to laugh." Who doesn't love to laugh? If you want to get married again, she says, don't be afraid to say so. and no need to play the cool girl who pretends she likes whatever men like, has no demands, never gets angry, and is up for sex in whatever way a guy wants it. People in older age tend to be generally freer of expectations in dating and relationships. The assumption that you will merge households declines. If parents or your community pushed you to marry a certain type of person in your 20s because of religion, socioeconomic status, profession, race, sexuality, gender, that pressure may have dissipated or vanished. Indeed, several women, hetero and queer, told me that while they want love and long-term relationships, they can't imagine returning to commingling finances or giving up their space, their condo, apartment, or house after years of living on their own. Some are purposefully going slower in love now. I don't need to be attached at the hip anymore, says Louisa Kastner, a lesbian, divorced woman, referring to the enmeshment she felt in her previous relationships. Years ago, Helen Fisher briefly dated a man who was smart and interesting and lived across the country from her. Was I going to move from New York City away from my friends, she says? It wasn't worth it to me. She did eventually marry the writer John Tierney 3 years ago. He is 7 years younger than she is. They are in what is known as a living apart together relationship. She is in the same Manhattan apartment she has lived in for 28 years. He is in the Bronx. They talk every day and see each other most evenings. Other nights, she is typically out with her female friends, whom she has known far longer than her husband. And at the end of those evenings, she climbs into her own bed. When I first started dating online, it felt as if a fire hydrant had opened, men appearing across my feed from different geographic areas of different ages, races, professions. Since then, I have gone on dates and been in relationships with men who are smart, kind, funny, and irreverent, and who have lived in Maine, Boston, New York City, Ohio, which means I never would have met them without the apps. Dating beyond where I live is also possible because I occasionally go on the road for work, no longer have small children, and can afford some travel. H also started dating near and far after his divorce. He was 51 around the peak of men's online dating popularity. His feed filled with women. Some were highly educated and others less so. Some were his age and plenty 2 decades younger. They were nurses, teachers, librarians, women with jobs in marketing and PR, none of whom he ever would have met through friends or work. H was enamored with the seemingly endless possibilities. During his most intense dating weekends, he would have a couple of brunches, afternoon walks, drinks at 5 p.m. with one woman, and drinks with another at 8. He paid for it all unless he knew there would be no second date and the woman offered to split the bill. Some weeks he had 15 dates. I was saying, yes, 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 he told me. After a month he was overwhelmed, disillusioned, filled with too much coffee, alcohol, and scrambled eggs, and too many conversations in which he felt no connection. He paused all his apps and regrouped. Attraction mattered, sure, but he wanted women who were educated, successful, and enthusiastic, and also women who were mothers, so they could share parenting experiences and lived reasonably close by. And although he started off dating women who were more than 10 years younger, in a couple of cases more than 15, too often he had little in common with them and struggled to have substantive conversations. So he narrowed his age window, 8 years younger and 3 years older. Now at 57, with his own kids in college, he is clear he wants a partner with whom he can share the same life stage, interests, and living styles. Toward the end of my reporting, he restarted a relationship and moved in with a woman he met years ago through online dating, 2 states away from him. Love doesn't always stick to our dating rules. H and many people I interviewed said that this time around, they were looking for different qualities in a partner. Some told me they want a person who is more positive and less anxious. Others long for a partner who is less of a workaholic or who cares more about their work. or after being married to someone with a very different temperament, they want a person more like them. After years in therapy, they want a partner more emotionally intelligent and sensitive, or they have chosen a less materialistic life after decades with someone who relished big houses filled with possessions. When Frances Rousseau, who has been widowed twice and is now in her late 70s, began online dating, she met her second husband that way and her current partner of 8 years. She initially wanted men who had the same level of education and were as financially comfortable as she was. Over time, she realized she would miss out on men who were devoted to artistic careers or who had low-paying but meaningful jobs. "Who cares if he can't afford the same restaurants you like," says Rousseau, who is the author of Love After 50, How to Find It, Enjoy It, and Keep It. "People say, 'I don't want to settle,'" she told me. "But if you have someone who adores you and wants to hear about your day, but doesn't have a fancy degree or a lot of money, I don't consider that settling." She also argues that older people are better at dealing with dating rejection. There's disappointment, but if someone doesn't want a fourth date with you, you've survived far worse than that. A week, a month from now, it won't matter. In her book, she quotes a therapist who talks about catch-and-release relationships. "We get more skilled at sorting the good fit from the bad fit, and we let people go faster." John, who is 65 and lives in Western Massachusetts, did a lot of catching and releasing in his late 50s because he didn't get to do it when he was younger. By his early 20s, he was living with the woman he eventually married. In his first months of dating, he met women who lived nearby where he grew up. But he quickly realized he didn't want the familiar. He knew where they shopped, the books they were reading, where they went to school. In comparison, dating women in more far-flung areas with backgrounds very different from his was totally exotic. As a successful painter, he had a flexible schedule, and he had enough money to plan weekend-long trips to Boston and New York City to meet women, setting up multiple dates over a couple of days, something he couldn't afford to do in his 20s. His method flew in the face of lots of dating advice. He chose women based on photos and paid less attention to what they wrote. "The profile was just a way to sit across from someone and have a conversation," says John, who approached the entire endeavor with curiosity. "For me it was, 'Can I learn something here? Is there something new for me?'" When he was 61, he sublet an apartment in New York City for a couple of months to make and see art, to date, to be near his adult children. Just before he arrived, he matched with a woman named Elizabeth, who was 57. Unlike John, Elizabeth had a dating system. Like several women and men I talked to, she listed her age as several years younger than she was to widen the dating pool, and she wasn't interested in anyone beyond Manhattan and Brooklyn. When she matched with someone, she messaged only a few times on the site before suggesting a phone call. She passed on men who hadn't been married or in long-term relationships. The guys in their late 50s with serial girlfriends their whole lives? I mean, come on. No. Some didn't make it past the phone call. "I'm sorry," she would say. "I don't think we're a match." At which point, one man started cursing at her and called her a bitch. Of the roughly 24 men she did date over 2 years, most were lawyers or business professionals. But then John liked her on an app. She was attracted to him and impressed by his educational background. They talked on the phone and made plans for a drink with, as Elizabeth told him, the possibility of dinner. They had dinner. She liked how funny and positive he was. He was taken with her. She was beautiful, successful, strong-willed. "We would have never crossed paths," Elizabeth says. "No one would have set us up." The lifelong New Yorker who didn't want to get involved with men much beyond her borough ended up moving to Massachusetts during the pandemic just months after their first date. They married in September 2021 at an inn not far from where they now live. "For the last several months, I've gotten together with a group of friends, women mostly in their 50s and separated or divorced, dating for the first time in decades. When we aren't talking about work, divorce, and kids, some in the group pass around their phones with profiles of men they're dating or might be interested in. In one case, two people matched with the same guy. We discussed the vicissitudes of dating and relationships, local and long distance, and what and who we want. Always in some way, the conversation comes around to sex. Some describe their sex experiences after marriage as the most expansive of their lives. After one woman divorced, she set her online age parameters for men down to their 20s and 30s with the intention of having flings. She made sure they lived in a different neighborhood so she could separate her hookups from the rest of her life. She is now in a relationship with a man about her age. Another woman, who has spent several months dating widely, was trying a non-monogamous relationship for the first time and toying with bisexuality in three ways. She wasn't clear where she would land, but she was open to possibilities. Men, too, told me sex and dating post-50 have been an evolving experience. In his 20s, any sex was good sex, H says. But now he aspires to what the sex advice columnist and podcaster Dan Savage calls GGG, or good, giving, and game. As Savage puts it, good in bed, giving of pleasure, and game for anything, within reason. It can be a tricky concept to convey on dating apps, though not on the app field, where talk about sex is expected, and GGG is among the desires people can choose. If you are a guy who puts GGG on your profile, women may think you are a creep, H told me. Instead, he waits to talk about sex in person, often broadly broaching the subject during the first date if it's going well. I want to convey that I'm looking for someone who is sensual and cares about sex, and that I'm the same way. Other people told me they talk more openly about sex because bodies change. Men have increased erectile dysfunction. Women often need more lubrication or sex toys and sometimes experience pain with intercourse. I didn't know myself, says a woman named Teresa, referring to her 20s and 30s, and I definitely didn't know my body in the same way. Teresa, who is in her early 50s and lives on the West Coast, never masturbated until late in her marriage. I got my first dildo at 40 and discovered multiple orgasms. Where has this been all my life? Everyone, she says, does that exchange in dating where they talk about their marriage. I always say I've been divorced on paper 5 years, but longer emotionally and physically. Within a couple of dates, Teresa, who a friend refers to as an online dating queen because she has gone on more than 100 first dates in 5 years, tells men about her experience with masturbation and orgasms. It's part of my story, she says. She also talks about what she learned from a therapist who counseled her and her ex-husband that sex is more than penetration. I want to be having intimacy in my 80s, she says. It's also about cuddling naked, skin-to-skin contact. What she is looking for isn't novelty, but the harder stuff, as she puts it, being open and vulnerable. Sophia Chang, who is 58, the author of the memoir, The Baddest Bitch in the Room, and the founder of a professional mentorship program for women of color in New York, definitely wants the intensity. But I get very little play compared to my friends who are a decade younger than me, she says, of online dating. She assumes if a man from a dating app is texting her, he is doing the same with at least 5 other women. Plenty have asked her for nude selfies, and she suspects that people who claim to be ethically non-monogamous are often just cheating on their partners. I don't do messy, she says. When her relationship with the father of her children ended, she was 43 and felt done with sex. But in her 50s, after a relationship with a man who encouraged her to be more sexually open, Chang felt increasingly libidinous. She also became an empty nester, giving her freedom, including with her sexuality. Younger men tell me that what they like about older women is that they know their bodies and ask for what they want. Last year, she joined 2 dating apps where, when she matches with a man, she moves quickly from texts to phone calls or FaceTime. When we last talked, she told me that week she had gone from matching with a man on an app to texting to FaceTime to meeting outdoors and then having sex in the space of 12 hours. On the phone, she is frank. "Can you tell me what you like and what you don't like, and I'll do the same?" Then she details some of her desires and sexual kinks and her boundaries, including no unprotected sex. Sometimes after connecting, men ask to come over immediately to have sex. "Excuse me," Chang told me, she says. "I have a safety accountability practice. I tell them I need to send their photo, full name, and phone number to a friend. That is where some men push back hard." Until she finds the right matches, she continues to unabashedly audition men who connect with her on dating apps. At her age, she, like many women I spoke to, has a better sense of who she is and what she desires and sees no point in hiding it. "If I bat my eyes, I could get further. But for what? There's no sense in wasting time when life is growing too short." Maggie Jones, who wrote this article, is a contributing writer for the magazine and teaches writing at the University of Pittsburgh. I would just now like to take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now, our next article from the New York Times Magazine Modern Love edition, "The Poems That Taught Me How to Love, Lessons from Pablo Neruda's Mind-Bending Verse." This article was written by Nicholas Casey. My friend Ravi introduced me to the love poems of Pablo Neruda when we were teenagers. On the cover of the writer's selected poems, Neruda stands wearing a checkered beret, his hands clasped, with the painted statue of a woman looming in the background. His eyes have the look of a man whose heart has been broken many times. "Tonight I can write the saddest lines," begins one of the first poems in the collection. "I loved her, and sometimes she loved me too." Not all of his poetry is so somber. I'm thinking now of the line, "I want to do with you what spring does with the cherry trees." On the page, Neruda is always mixing intense landscape imagery and the emotions they evoke in him, using nature as a transcendent metaphor for the erotic. But I wanted to read these lines out loud, and did so, ill-advisedly, to a girl I liked in Spanish class. Maybe I was drawn to Neruda because then his simple, straightforward verses were the only poetry I could understand in Spanish. With selected poems, I was learning the language, but I was hoping Neruda could teach me to talk to women, too. When I turned 19, I was finally Neruda's age when he published his first book of love poems. I was a college junior and longing to see Chile after years of Spanish classes. I came to Santiago as a study abroad student in the summer of 2004. I knew South America was my place when I found an older woman collecting change on the metro while reciting Neruda's 20th love poem. The other passengers mouthed the verses with her. Finally, at the end of the term, I got a ticket to Patagonia to see the southern landscapes that I had imagined while reading Neruda. "Ah, vastness of pines, murmur of waves breaking," read one. "Twilight falling in your eyes." And yet, unlike in the poems, I had no muse, a fact cruelly highlighted by the waiter in Punta Arenas who told me I could not order the crab stew because it was only for two. It was my last day in Ushuaia, and I was in the attic of the hostel where I was staying with the Neruda book in my bag when I met someone. She told me she was German and studied Latin American literature at the Free University of Berlin. That seemed to be enough to have signaled destiny to me. There were also the little coincidences that had poetry of their own. When we left town the next day, we were assigned seats together on the bus, as if by fate. It was an 11-hour ride, which included a short ferry over the Strait of Magellan, and we poured our hearts out to each other. Then we got to Punta Arenas. We ran into the same waiter I saw when I was alone days before. He looked at her, then at me, and reached out to shake my hand, smiling. We went to bed, separate ones. I was still a shy teenage poem reader, and I read her Neruda's The Queen. When you go through the streets, no one recognizes you. No one sees your crystal crown. No one looks at the carpet of red gold that you tread as you pass. By morning, I knew I had to do more than read something to her, but there was time only for a walk to the bus station and then my ride to the airport. She gave me a hug and I got on the bus. Suddenly, the bus was rolling out of the station and she was waving at it, and at that moment, my heart was breaking. Finally, I had some presence of mind. I went to the driver and said, "Please stop the bus, I forgot something." The driver stopped and I got off to give her a long kiss. I looked her in the eyes and then went to Santiago. This, it seemed, had been the greatest accomplishment of my life to that point. In my journal, I documented it with my own Nerudian lines. Walking to the bus was the feeling of being besieged on all sides by the perfect day, with the certainty that no matter how hard you step, that fragile perfection, crafted long ago by some distant genius, will keep giving you sure footing. The footing didn't last long enough. No texts came on my cell phone for a couple of weeks, and then she told me she had a boyfriend back in Germany named Jan. "Tonight I can write the saddest lines," goes the Neruda poem. I'm all right now, as Robert Frost once wrote. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Neruda's poems feel more sentimental today than they did back then. I realize they belong to a time, long gone, when he and I were both 19 and still coming of age. When the idea of being a writer finally came to me, I was drawn less by the pangs of the heart and more to the suffering of wars and conflict, and became a foreign correspondent. In Madrid, where I live these days, I still have my copy of selected poems. Neruda's face looks out timelessly from the cover. It gives me chills when I see that the same pages that were white when I first read them are yellowing after 20 years. Nicholas Casey, who wrote this article, is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. He has spent a decade as a foreign correspondent in Europe, Latin America, and the Middle East. And now our next article from the Screenland section of this, the Modern Love edition of the New York Times Magazine, the rom-com that's responsible for my marriage. The 1992 movie Singles changed my life. This article was written by Sam Anderson. Dear 1994 Sam Anderson, hello, it's me, 2024 Sam Anderson, you from the future, exactly 30 years from now. I'm explaining because you are bad at math. I am typing this on technology that doesn't exist yet. I'm older than your parents currently are. I have a big beard and my lower back hurts, and I spend most of my time playing word games or reading apocalyptic news alerts on the supercomputer I keep in my pocket. The 21st century, to be honest, sucks. To put it in terms you'll understand, we're trying to swing on the flippity-flop, but we're living in a harsh realm. But I don't want to scare you. There are good things, too. Wireless earbuds, exciting new flavors of Doritos, Weird Al Yankovic is still going strong. And your life has turned out better than you have any right to expect. You do not die of that thing you think you are dying of. You are allowed to write goofy things like this for your job. And the biggest miracle of all, you have a stable, loving, long-term marriage. For that last one, you owe a serious debt of gratitude to a classic film, the 1992 romantic comedy Singles. Well, it's a classic for me. You have just now seen it on your first date with Sarah from math class. This, in fact, is the main reason I'm writing, to tell you that 30 years from now, you and Sarah will still be together, and Singles will be such a pillar of your relationship that you will celebrate your 30th dating anniversary Valentine's Day 2024 by rewatching it. You will see it this time from a very different angle. You will marvel at the passage of time, at the ways that the world and you yourselves are exactly the same but also radically different, and how things that once struck you as extremely cool still strike you as extremely cool, but are now also drenched in sadness. Rewatching Singles with Sarah will feel life-affirming, like an unofficial renewal of your vows, and you will realize that this film, this ancient, light-hearted 99-minute comedy, has been the most important movie of your life. These days, Singles is remembered mainly as a novelty, the grunge rom-com. It was filmed in Seattle in 1991 as the city's scruffy rock bands drifted improbably towards global superfame. And it came out in 1992 with grunge mania in full bloom, Nirvana topping the charts, journalists flocking to Seattle, fashion designers scrambling to put flannel on the runway. Singles is to grunge basically as Saturday Night Fever is to disco. Scenes take place in Seattle clubs where Soundgarden and Alice in Chains play live. Members of Pearl Jam are minor characters. The soundtrack is so packed that it was rushed into stores months before the movie reached theaters. Given all that, I worried Singles might not hold up. But I'm happy to report that it is still delightful. This is largely because of Cameron Crowe, the writer-director responsible for such immortal rom-com moments as Guy in Trench Coat Holds Up Boombox, Say Anything, and You Had Me at Hello, Jerry Maguire, which you'll see in a few years. With Singles, Crowe was ambitious, trying to capture the vibe of a whole scene, a whole city. It is a collage of a film with more than 75 speaking parts. The main characters are 20-somethings who live in the same apartment building and hang around the same coffee shop. Crowe claims that Singles inspired Friends, a sitcom that will soon dominate the world. There is Janet, Bridget Fonda, an architecture student who is infatuated with Cliff, Matt Dillon, a doofusy singer in a band called Citizen Dick. There is Debbie, Sheila Kelly, who searches for love through a VHS dating service called Expect the Best. There are cameos from young, to me, versions of Paul Giamatti, Jeremy Piven, Eric Stoltz, and Tim Burton. Characters keep speaking directly to the camera, trading off as narrators. It's a perfect blend of indie film and slick rom-com. I know you just finished watching it, but I am reminding you of all this because you spent most of the film distracted, trying not to projectile vomit from anxiety. You desperately wanted the date to go well. Sarah was your months-long crush, the girl you noticed the moment she walked in, on the first day of school, wearing a yellow dress. She, too, is bad at math, thank goodness, because that's how you each ended up in this remedial class, where the teacher lets you goof around, where Sarah is allowed to get up in front of the room and tell funny childhood stories, and sometimes you go up and pantomime them like an old-timey clown. Finally, after months of this, she gave you her number, and when she came over, she brought the VHS tape of Singles. It's better for us that Singles has been largely forgotten because it still feels small and private like a time capsule. Its characters talk on big clunky phones and discuss the Seattle Supersonics. A major plot point involves an answering machine eating a cassette tape. None of these are things anymore. And there is the grunge. You, as a moody white teenager from the Pacific Northwest, are fully devoted to that lifestyle. You wear long johns under your shorts. You learned guitar by copying Kurt Cobain's fingers. You are driving your mother crazy by never washing your hair. But what makes Singles perfect for you and Sarah goes deeper than flannel. It is the movie's central love story. In a world of goofballs, Linda, Kyra Sedgwick, and Steve, Campbell Scott, seem like adults. They have meaningful careers they are passionate about. Linda works for an environmental organization. Steve wants to solve Seattle's traffic problems with a super train. They go to rock concerts, but also love to stay home and talk. They are smart enough to understand, even as they are falling in love, that relationships are never easy, never perfect. Theirs will be so imperfect, in fact, that late in the movie it falls apart. But then it comes back together, stronger for its imperfections. As Steve puts it, drunkenly, on Linda's answering machine, "We had good times and bad times, but we had times." Looking back, I can see the appeal of this for two teenagers who were desperate to start their own lives. You didn't have many examples in your own childhood of mature, healthy, long-term relationships. You needed singles, and you needed Sarah from math class. Very long story, very short. You and Sarah will make a life like that. She will support you in your grunge inclinations. She will tolerate the wasteland of your hair. She will borrow your t-shirts and wear flannels over them, and one day she will drive you to get your nose pierced by a lady at a sidewalk table, which will cause a minor scandal in your family and get you uninvited from a big church event. But also, just as crucial, she won't support you too much. When you are thinking of delaying college to see what happens with your band, Station Wagon, she will advise against it, and she will be right, because I am sorry to break this to you, but your songs are pretty bad. Over the years, she will be relentless in getting you out of the depressive turtle shell you're always trying to disappear into. She will encourage you to participate in the world. Visit Europe, go to therapy, adopt a dog. She will persuade you to have children, which will turn out to be the very best thing you ever do. Eventually, your teenage daughter will borrow your old t-shirts and wear flannels over them, too. One year on a work trip to Seattle, you will make a pilgrimage to the singles apartment building, which still looks just as it did in the movie. You will take a picture of yourself there and send it to Sarah. You will think about the big Seattle voices that are now gone, Cobain, Cornell, Staley, and consider what a miracle it is that you are still here and that you and Sarah are still together. Of course, it has not been perfect. You have had good times and bad times, but you have had times. Sam Anderson, who wrote this article, is an American author who is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and the author of Boomtown, a book about Oklahoma City. Surprisingly enough, we have a few minutes left, so with those few minutes, I will read to you from the Ethicist column, also from This, the Modern Love Edition of the New York Times Magazine. As always, these ethical dilemmas are answered by Kwame Anthony Appiah. Kwame Anthony Appiah is the New York Times Magazine ethicist columnist and also teaches philosophy at NYU. This first letter comes from someone who, as is typically the case, has their name withheld. "My boyfriend said he'd save our cat, but not a stranger if both were drowning. My boyfriend and I were talking about protecting human life, and he said that he doesn't believe that human life is necessarily worth more than any other kind of life. For example, he said that if one of our cats were drowning next to a human who was a stranger to us, who was also drowning, and he could save just one, he would choose our cat. Is this morally wrong?" And the ethicist responds, "For many people, pets are fictive kin. They're considered part of the family. In one study, I've seen hundreds of people were asked to consider how they'd respond if their pet ran in front of a bus at the same time that a foreign tourist stepped in front of it. They can only save one. The other will be killed. Which would they rescue?" What the experimental psychologist Richard Topolsky and colleagues found was that about 40% of respondents said they'd save their pet. If the choice were between their pet and a hometown stranger, the numbers dropped by just a few percentage points. A distant cousin, almost a quarter of respondents, still put their pet first. Not just any pet, mind you. They were choosing their pet. These aren't people with some grave defect of character. They have a duty of care toward their animal companion. The creature depends on them, and over time they've developed a strong bond, a sense of affection, companionship, loyalty, all twined around a whole lot of memories. So the choice of plumping for your pet is, you could say, very human. But yes, it's very wrong. In states with duty to rescue laws, it could be illegal too. Those human strangers? They had rich emotional lives and they had plans, short-term and long-term, big and small. It's a good guess that they were also part of other people's plans, other people's emotional lives. They had friends, co-workers, kin, dependents, maybe some assortment of parents, children, siblings, cousins, and possibly a spouse or life companion. You can expect the suffering that their death will bring to be deep, the ripple effects wide. We shouldn't assume that how people respond on questionnaires will necessarily predict how they'll respond in real life, of course. Still, to see the full, reciprocal, and socially enmeshed humanity of an abstract stranger can take work. I'm saying that your boyfriend is wrong. I'm not saying that he's rotten. The more pressing question for you is this: if he had to choose between you and one of those cats, would he have to think it over? This next letter comes from someone who lives in France and has their name withheld. My girlfriend said she loved me. Should I say it back, even if I'm not sure? I've been dating my girlfriend for more than 6 months now, and we've been going along really well ever since we first met. Time together is always of quality, and I care a lot about her. A few weeks ago, she told me for the first time that she loved me. Although her words meant a lot to me, it led me to believe that I wasn't sure I actually loved her, though I cared deeply about our relationship. Is it wrong to say I love you if I'm not sure? I'm actually in love? I'm afraid this could lead us to end our relationship otherwise. And the ethicist responds, having watched a few romantic comedies in my life, or has it been a few thousand, I am familiar with this quandary. One partner worries about having derailed a relationship by blurting out, "I love you," too soon, or is flummoxed by the surprise declaration, or wonders why "I love you" is answered only with ditto, same, or back at ya. All that seems true to life. So is the fact that people in relationships are highly adept at drawing distinction within the language of devotion. "I love you, but I'm not in love with you," or "I do love you, but not that way." What's worth bearing in mind is that an avowal of love can have meanings beyond its words. The French philosopher Emmanuel Levinas made much about the difference between the saying and the said. The said is just the content of whatever proposition you've asserted, but the saying is an act, a way of opening yourself up to another. Your girlfriend, beyond expressing her sense of desire and devotion, was making herself vulnerable, perhaps signaling her commitment to the relationship and testing whether you reciprocated it. That's clearly the effect it had, given your current soul-searching. I'd suggest that you try speaking to her, opening yourself up to her with a full heart. As your copine surely knows, people in a couple who come to love each other don't necessarily do so simultaneously. It sounds as if she's willing to give you time and space to develop your feelings at your own pace, and an honest conversation is how the deeper ethical work of love happens, the work of seeing, honoring, and caring. But if she has a vision of a shared future that doesn't resonate with you, if you consider the relationship comfortable but not necessarily for keeps, in that case, exaggerating your feelings in order to preserve the status quo would amount to breadcrumbing, leading her on and preventing her from moving along with her life. The prototype breadcrumber is the manipulative cad who just wants to keep all options open on a Friday night. More typical breadcrumbers, I suspect, are driven not by cynicism, but by uncertainty, and by a desire to avoid conflict. They may tell themselves that they're being kind as they postpone a reckoning, and we all know how that movie ends. I think I can squeeze one more letter in, and this one also is from someone who has had their name withheld. On a few occasions, I went to Overeaters Anonymous meetings. I remember a woman sharing about how she used to steal other people's food from the shared refrigerator where she was employed. Imagine my surprise when she showed up for a job interview a few months later where I was working. I didn't tell anyone about her. Was I correct in protecting her anonymity? The ethicist responds, "The name is a giveaway. Meetings like those of Overeaters Anonymous are meant to be zones of confidentiality. People confess to things there because they think the information won't be used against them. Without that protection, the meetings wouldn't work as they are supposed to. Given that this woman had been dealing with her compulsive eating, it was surely less likely that she'd steal food again. But even if there was a chance of that, it wasn't a big enough risk to justify the breach of confidentiality. And if she had become a coworker, you could have taken her aside and offered to help if she ever felt tempted." Thank you very much for joining me for this, the Modern Love edition of the New York Times Magazine. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.